Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development, Monday, March 23rd. I apologize for a little bit late start. We're moving things around, and unfortunately, Representative Gallegos is not feeling well today, so we're going to proceed without him. We're going to start with our work session on House Bill 2728. Victoria, if you could remind us about that bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2728 establishes the Oregon Talent Council and specifies responsibilities, requires council to develop talent development plan and update each biennium, establishes Oregon Talent Council fund in state treasury, and appropriates monies to council for purposes of act, abolishes Engineering and Technology Industry Council and associated fund and account, transfers money in fund and account to Oregon Talent Council fund, requires council to identify state agency with which to be affiliated, declares emergency, is effective on passage. We have dash two amendments, which are going to be explained to us by people who know way more about them than I do. The measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We did get a fiscal late Friday, but it just basically said further analysis required.
This is the proverbial fiscal light. So, Ms. Scruggs, if you could come forward, and I think you're bringing Laura and Lindsay with you, please. So again, we're looking at the dash two amendments, colleagues.
Dash one's not going anywhere.
No, the dash twos. They'll correct me if I get this wrong. I think are derivative of the dash ones with a couple further tweaks.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. So, is this on here?
Excuse me, Chair. Is anybody else having OLIS issues, or is it just me?
Yes.
I see nothing here.
Okay.
I was able, I think, successfully to do, theorizing on my part, there was a refresh and update over the weekend. I think trying to disconnect and reconnect may help you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Ms. Crooks.
Okay. Hi. Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Pat Scruggs. I'm president of Scruggs & Associates, a national consulting company. Again, I'd like to thank members of the committee for this work session. On February 27th, myself, along with about a dozen other leaders from industry, other state agencies, and education, testified to the value of the Oregon Talent Council. I'm here today to talk to you about the Dash 4 amendments and, with our resource panel, answer any questions that you may have concerning the bill. As a quick reminder, as we said, we established the Oregon Talent Council. A statewide plan appropriates money. It does abolish ETIC, and it will reside within the Oregon Employment Department, but with written coordination agreements with the Higher Education Council, the Workforce Boards, the STEM Investment Councils, and Business Oregon. The Dash 2 amendments is basically three very short and brief amendments to this bill. We added the role of acting as a resource for state agencies. Right now it just said advise. The Dash 1 amendments were advise. So this is advise and act as a resource for state agencies and councils. This was at the request of the Higher Education Coordinating Council because they wanted to see this as a partnership and not just a passive advisory role. Okay. The other thing was in the Dash 1 amendments compared to the introduced bill, the Higher Education Council was accidentally removed from one of the sections as one of the partners, and so it just got placed back in. And we had two word corrections where, to be consistent with the language of the bill, we basically put in that they shall in two places, and those are the Dash 4 amendments. Dash 2 amendments. Four things for the Dash 2 amendments. Sorry, that was it. And so those are the amendments, and if there's questions about the bills, others, we have our resource team here, which I can introduce, or we can...
Very good. Would either of you like to say anything before we see if there are questions? I don't know if there will be questions or not. No? Okay. So I had one question,
yes.
And it may be that I just missed it in reviewing the amendment. They're typically, in my experience, in these sorts of concepts, language around the fund being able to accept contributions from any source and that sort of thing. I assume that's the intent. If we found a generous philanthropist who wanted to fund something, that the fund could do that. I may have missed the language, but not that I'm hung up on that specific language. I just wanted to make sure that is consistent with the intent. If we need that, I'm sure that could be added later. But am I right in thinking that would be the intent?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, yes, that is the intent. And I do believe that in the bill it says the fund will be able to accept monies from in other amounts deposited in the fund from any source.
Very good. That's slightly different language than I was used to seeing, so that's probably why I missed
it. Yes, it is slightly different from what I am as well. So, yes, and that is in Section 4, in Section 4-2D.
Okay. Very good. Are there other questions? Anything else, Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, I guess, is for the Chair or Mrs. Cox. This is the second bill, I think, it seems we're changing policy in the building, that it's not the governor appointing the members, it's a department in consultation with the governor or the governor's designated representative. Is that a change in policy in the building?
I would say that it's not. I'm not aware of any change in the building. I think this is something to consider within the context of this bill, and I'd certainly invite comments from the panel. But I think part of the intent is to make sure that the directors of the department, the folks who are doing the on the ground work, so to speak, have a chance to find the right people who would be part of the council. But please. Add to that if I've missed something.
Yeah. Oh, Jerry, just to clarify, I'm just reading it also, and it says the governor will have a designated representative who will chair, and five members are appointed by the governor, but they're not confirmed by the Senate. Is that correct?
I don't believe so.
I believe that's correct.
I don't think you're right.
And I'm struggling like we all are after Representative Rudin pointed out the difficulty in connecting. I thought I'd done
it. I
can't connect either. So we're all kind of scrambling.
So it's very small.
Yes. Thanks.
But is that correct? And then it designates who the others represent.
The question, as I understand it, is how the members are appointed and whether they are confirmed by the Senate.
Can they read Section 1?
That's what I'm reading. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Consultation of the governor's designated representative may appoint.
Yep. No, I think that is right. The director of the employment department, this is Section 1, sub 1, mm-hmm. Director of the employment department, in consultation with the governor or the governor's designated representative, may appoint the council members, the majority of whom must be senior executives of traded sector and high-growth industries in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, my background, again, I mean, it sounds like who's responsible? The employment department works for the governor. And we're going to say the governor's not—he's not going to be the one responsible for this. He may even let his designated representative. And then, as it said, we don't have. There's no legislative oversight except the report. The report does go to the governor, and to the annual report goes to the governor and the legislature.
Representative Wisnett, I'm happy to have the panel weigh in too. My sense is that ultimately, you make the good point that the employment department director does work for the governor, so there's that connection. And furthermore, I think the council is going to just have the ability to make recommendations, but action on those recommendations are generally going to be back to the legislature. And I understand, if we we could ask the governor's office this too, but my sense has been, and with some direct experience on some of these things, the number of appointments and posts they have to fill can end up being really overwhelming and slowing down that work and that process. So,
Mr. Chair, this is an important one, and we're giving designating a little bit of money, significant amount of money. Are there other? Do we know of? If there's other, how did the ETEC? Good, thank you. How did the ETEC chain of command work?
Chair Harid, Representative Wisnett, members of the committee, and Laura McKinney, who directs ETEC, can confirm this. But this, that ETEC was appointed in the same manner here, but with under higher ed. So this was actually, this is language carried over from ETEC, but also this was, this language was at the request of the governor's office under Governor Kitzhaber. So the reason this bill is in here, this language was, it was a carryover to how ETEC operated, and that was at the request.
Please. Thank you for that. And so again, then I would ask, did that work? Was there problems with that? So you're proposing the same chain of command. I'm sorry for using that term, but
So Rep. Reed and Rep. Wisnett, I want to make sure that we clarify that chain of command. So ETIC had a recommendation authority to the State Board of Higher Education, which confirmed the recommendations of ETIC long run. I believe it worked very well. The State Board of Higher Ed took the recommendations from the industry council in full form, and I think it was working very well to have the chancellor of the State Board of Higher Education appointing the members of the council. And based on the chancellor's actions, the council itself most of the time were finding and recommending to the chancellor, and the chancellor that was then confirming those. So it was a very industry-driven approach to the high tech council.
Thank you for those comments. Were there ever, Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, please.
Were there ever members asked to resign or because of calls or conflict or something like that?
I've only been with the council for 2 years, so I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to talk further back than that. So I apologize for that. I can get that information for you. Not to my knowledge.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Rep. Wisnett referenced a question regarding the chairmanship of the committee, or the talent council. It does clearly say that the council shall select one of its private sector members as a chairperson. So that's where the leadership of the council will come from. Further, though, I just did wanted to comment, Pat, about, I think it's in section 2, sub 7, if I'm not mistaken here, but I was reading this yesterday, and this may have been in the original bill, but I just noticed it yesterday, and almost fell out of my chair because I liked what I saw so much. The Oregon
Don't do it now, please.
I was in my easy chair.
Okay.
The Oregon Talent Council, the Oregon Business Development Commission, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, the STEM Investment Council, state and local workforce boards, and the Employment Department shall develop agreements to, here's the key word, strategically align the policies and programs of the entities as they relate to the duties of the Oregon Talent Council. I can't tell you what a refreshing phrase that is to say strategic alignment of efforts. It's great to see. It's something we need in a lot more situations. It's just simply the Talent Council. So I'm very enthused about that. Thanks.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Chair Reed, may I?
Yes, please.
Remember, and that is the one place where the Higher Education Coordinating Council was removed, accidentally removed, and Amendment 1 put back in. As you got, so when I said that, that was the section, and now you know why that was very important to make sure that they were back in. Thank you.
Well said. Other questions, Representative Wisnett?
Just like to, for the one of our colleagues asked about, so the amount of money we're going to put in there is $8 million, and that'll go through Ways and Means, or how much is the money we're going to have?
So it says 15 at the end of the bill in Section 10, and yes, it's going to Ways and Means. I don't think we could claim that $15 million is anything below the threshold for Ways and Means. Yes, it's headed there. Other questions, comments? We are in work session.
Chair Reed, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-12-15.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett has moved the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-12-15. Is there any discussion of that motion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. The dash two amendments are adopted. Representative Wisnant.
Chair Reed, I move House Bill 2728 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant has moved House Bill 2728 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2728 is on its way to Ways and Means, where at least three members of this committee will have a chance to interact with it as well. Thank you very much.
Thank
Close
you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2728 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3308. Before Victoria gives us a summary, this is Representative Gallegos' bill. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, he's not feeling well, so we're going to proceed with a number of other people to hear the bill, and I imagine he'll have something to say about it when he comes back. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3308 directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to convene a work group to analyze and make recommendations on how to address disparities in higher education among traditionally marginalized, underserved, and underrepresented communities. Requires work group to submit report detailing analysis and recommendations to Interim Legislative Committee on Higher Education by September 15, 2015. Sunsets the work group on December 31, 2016, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Thank you. And Mario, I understand you're going to pinch hit for Representative Gallegos a bit. And while you're getting settled, I'm just going to call a couple more people up to join you in those other seats. Michaela Martin, it's hard to read. Okay, perfect. And Tia Gomez-Zeller. Sir.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisnant, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mario Parker Milligan. I'm the Legislative Director with the Oregon Student Association. House Bill 3308 is about addressing disparities in higher education for underrepresented communities. And even more, it's about ensuring that students have all the tools they need and faculty and staff have all the tools they need to ensure that students are completing and have successful outcomes while in college. We know through extended research through that the HEC does on an annual basis that underrepresented communities such as students of color, non-traditional students, students with disabilities, student veterans, student parents, and students whose first language is not English aren't completing college at the same rates as their peers. And this bill is a first step in analyzing how we are able to address some of those disparities directly in the classroom. You may remember some of the members may remember a bill in 2011 and 2013 that addressed disparities in health in the healthcare field through cultural competency continuing education, and how healthcare professionals needed more resources to better serve their patients. And this is a similar concept. Our faculty, our staff, and folks who are working directly with students on campus don't have necessary skills to work with the growing diverse populations on our campuses. So we're looking to the HEC to work with faculty, work with students and staff and administrators to address some of these disparities and come up with options for continuing education that address those. And you may also see it in the bill. We're asking that the HEC work with the Oregon Health Authority, who recently finished a rulemaking for the healthcare professionals for continuing education with cultural competency specifically. So we know that they have institutional memory. They've already done a lot of the research that we're looking for the HEC to pull together for higher education. And we're not wanting them to necessarily reinvent the wheel, but use some of the best practices and standards that have already been established by the Oregon Health Authority. You'll hear from some of our members today around some of their personal experiences on campus working with faculty, working with staff to address these disparities, and even more importantly, some of the issues that students have faced in the classroom. A few of our campuses have taken steps to address these. Portland State University and Lane Community College have have done a lot of the work necessary to implement some of these policies on campus, but we're looking for some statewide standards that can apply to and be adapted by regional universities, community colleges, and the larger research universities as well.
Very good. Thank you. Let's hear from our other panelists, and then we'll see if there are questions. Who'd like to go first?
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Okay. Good morning, Chair Reed, a member of the Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development Committee. I thought I have a long name. My name is Tia Marie Gomez-Seller, and I want to thank this body for bringing up such important issue as the lack of cultural competency is in higher education. HB 3308 has multiple significance for me as a student, and as a student affairs professional. In fact, I'm a graduate student pursuing my master's degree in education, leadership, and policy. And last Monday at this time, I was turning my 327 pages thesis called Bring Cultural Competency to PSU from Theory to Practice. And this morning, I got the good news that I passed.
Congratulations.
Master of Science right now, which makes me very happy. However, the process to get there haven't made me that much happy. As a graduate student and in my multiple role with the Associate Student of Portland State University, ASPSU Student Government, I had the opportunity to conduct a pilot study. So we collect more than 1,000 surveys and conducting 17 focus groups among students of different backgrounds in PSU. And what we found is a statistically significant difference among the percentage of faculty and staff perceived as culturally competent by a student of diverse background. So this difference fluctuates from the highest of 72% as perceived by Caucasian students to a lowest of 55% of faculty being perceived as culturally competent as perceived by Native American. This percent goes even lower when we're looking into staff and gender and sexual minorities. We also explore student experience through the focus group and the open question and the survey. And we found experience around discrimination, assumption and stereotype, problematic language, lack of support, lack of understanding, knowledge, and openness. Also, we found how important is the identity recognition, support, and openness together with having safe space like cultural center and resource centers are to retain those students and so that student can be success. During the focus group, many of our recent PSU students were mentioned having the same problems in other local community college like PCC. We observe power difference relations, sexist and racist remark, and including calling a student racial slurs for being black. We summarize this result with the conclusion that through their percentage and experience, we need cultural competency at PSU. As a result, ASPSU, together with faculty, staff, and students, got together and created a resolution that was followed by an official endorsement by the academic leadership team for a campus-wide policy on cultural competency. This academic team is composed by the vice provost of academic and all the deans. And since the fall, we have faculty and staff student meeting to create a policy. There were many questions that arise, there were many concerns that arise, and we have been trying to acknowledge them and address them into our best capacity. To celebrate these efforts, not everything was have to be sad. March 2nd, we have a cultural competency celebration where we have many of the resources, student groups, cultural centers getting all together, having food, having music, getting to do networking, getting to know what are the different resources. We also present the data of the focus group, and we present the policy that we have been creating through the fall and winter term. To finalize, we have Mr. Gallegos coming and being our closing speaker. Sadly, I wasn't able to give him the award, and I guess I won't be able to give him the award, but we wanted, from PSU, we don't only wanted to recognize Gallegos, but we wanted to recognize you all for recognizing that we need to do something. It's not only asking faculty and staff to treat a student as human beings, but it's also to offer them the skills that they will need to be successful in this globalized world. So thank you very much for your time, and I'm open for any question if you would like to hear more about the results, and I will pass in the awards and a summary of the results later on.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from your remaining panelists, and then we'll see if there are questions. Please.
My name is Michaela Martin. I'm a second-year student at Loon Benton Community College, and I'm here with the Oregon Student Association to encourage your support for the House Bill 3308. With our college and universities growing more diverse in their student populations, and with completion rates for many populations falling below our state goals, we must address these issues with intentional means, such as continuing education for our staff. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit nervous to share my story. As a student parent, I felt firsthand what it's like to have my identity attacked in the classroom. One particular instance was in my intro to communications class last term. The professor chose our impromptu speech topics for us. The topic I was given was positive aspects of your last ex. This brought back, it's kind of a triggering effect for me, it brought back negative memories experienced by myself and my son. My last ex-boyfriend was my son's father. These are memories of neglect and experiences of fear that I don't typically share with others. And the last thing I want to do is stand in front of my classroom to share these experiences. Sorry.
No, take your time. It's fine.
This is why I believe that we need stronger continuing education so that we can have safe and inclusive environments, especially for non-traditional students, student parents, and those affected by domestic violence. And this is why I support House Bill 3308. This bill would begin the conversation needed to provide for those who facilitate our learning environments. Thank you. Giving them useful tools for the unique experiences and the students that they interact with. Our classrooms are filling up with students from diverse backgrounds, and we need to be sure that our instructors are equipped to provide the educational services without providing harm to the students that they influence daily. And I hope they remember my story when voting on this bill, because this is why I support House Bill 3308.
Thank you.
It's very, sorry about that.
Not at all. You need not apologize. It's very helpful for us to hear from people who have direct perspective and direct experience.
Not something I talk about a lot. So
I understand.
Having it come up in class and to stand in front of, or sit in front of people and talk about it is like really difficult.
I understand. I appreciate you doing it. It adds a lot to our discussion.
Sorry.
Any questions for the panel?
Thank
Representative
you.
Nierman.
So, let's see, to Mr. Parker Milligan, thanks for your testimony. When you brought up that that you have these classes of people that aren't completing college, is that they're not starting college or that they're not finishing it, or can you talk to that a little bit?
Chair Reed, Representative Nierman, thank you for that question. We're finding that those these student populations aren't completing college or their programs at the same rates, or at, you know, nearly the same rates that other communities within our institutions are completing school. Traditionally aged students, folks who are coming directly out of high school, folks whose parents went to school, even that's the number one indicator of someone's success, is if their parents were college students and college graduates.
Thank you.
Okay. Follow up?
I don't have a follow up. Okay. I have another question.
Okay.
I'll defer to Representative McEwen.
Representative McEwen, then we'll come back to you.
Oh, great. Thank you, okay. Chair Reed. I'm going to make an assumption, and I'd like you to clarify it for me. I'm assuming this is not just Portland State statistics that you're using when you come to us. You're talking across the university system in Oregon.
Correct. Chair Reed, Representative McEwen, we're looking not just at universities but community colleges as well across the state.
Thank you.
Representative Nierman.
thanks. I'll just toss this out to any of the panelists, and maybe this is kind of a little bit of a deeper philosophical question, but so you have a list of different kind of classes of people here, and I almost part of me wants to say I wish the effort would just go into helping all students who are having trouble finishing, regardless of whatever. And I'm looking at some of the things on here. So one of them is people of color, and I'm thinking, and I don't know her case or anything like that, but like if Oprah Winfrey had a son or a daughter that went to school, that would be the only thing is just that they were color. I would say, I don't know, I don't expect that they would have special needs or special difficulties. Maybe they would. Or I went back to college at age 42, so I was a non-traditional student, and I would have been offended if anybody would have considered that I needed help or anything like that. I don't think I got any special help, and I did okay in school. Maybe I did need some help. I don't know. But I almost think that probably everybody in this room is in agreement that we want to help students get through college, all students. And I just wonder if that the effort might be better placed put some effort behind helping all students to finish college. And that's just a comment. Somebody can comment on my comment.
Yeah, sure. So how I see cultural competency, it doesn't only benefit a student of color or traditionally marginalized community. It helps every student. So we live in a globalized world more than ever. We're working with people in the USA. We're working with people in India. We're working with people in China. Our product gets sold all over the world, get produced in one country, sell in another, packet in another. So by bringing cultural competence into higher ed and making sure the faculty and staff have the awareness, knowledge, attitude, and skill that requires to pass on to students, we will make sure that we're creating employees and leaders that this globalized world need. So although in my look, it have this cultural competencies directly to just help traditionally marginalized community. If we're being thoughtful and looking into the bigger picture, we're going to see how this will be benefit for everyone, for the entire world. And we could be the lead in this. If you look at the literature review from emotional intelligence, cultural intelligence, multiple intelligence, global leadership, business, they're looking for those skills. Those attitudes, those awareness. It happened before where NASA spent thousands of millions of dollars because we were using miles and India were using kilometers, and we sent something to the space and there is $17 million thrown into the toilet. So making sure that not only the faculty and staff have the, again, awareness, knowledge, attitude, and skills, but they're giving to the students so when they go into the first place, they can communicate and work with their peers, regardless where they come from.
Thank you. Representative Reardon?
Yes, thank you very much for being here. It's very helpful. I'm just curious about the design of the survey. Was there a survey instrument? And if so, how was that designed? How many schools were contacted? What subgroups? How many people?
A little bit about that. Yeah. So for the construction of the survey, we look into different literature review on cultural competency. The biggest struggle is like there haven't been a study done as I wanted to do in PSU, but I have the great support of the director of the cultural centers, the international office, also our director of assessment in PSU. Together with my faculty advisor from the School of Education. And what we used was a six-like scale, looking into what are the pieces important for students to feel welcome and inclusive in the classroom. And we have an open question, and that was our way to look. Before the open question, we were asking a student, okay, based in this question, whether faculty and staff listen, understand your perspective, recognize your identity, support you, know about your challenge? What is the percent of faculty, and then what is the percent of staff that you consider to be culturally competent? Then we have two open questions, one asking, have you ever felt discriminated? And the other one asking, have you ever felt inclusive, welcome in the classroom? And we have extensive demographic part where they were all open questions, which make my work harder to code everything, but it was much helpful to see what are the different communities and what are the different struggles.
Just one follow-up. And how were those surveys distributed, at randomly or?
So we have different ways that we distributed. We sent two emails. They went to every student through the student government. We also have, again, the collaboration on the Cultural Center, Resource Center, International Office, who were sent through the listserv and the newsletter. We have diverse students going through different events and going to different buildings to make sure they were collecting the voice of the student that perhaps are not so engaged in the school.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you. Representative Jerry again.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Tia.
Okay. And by the way, congratulations on your master's degree.
Thank you.
You need to celebrate after you
get it. Celebrating here. Yes.
You keep bringing up the phrase cultural competency, and I don't see that in the bill. Is that what this bill is about? Is this is driving a cultural competency program? Is that your understanding of the bill?
That's my understanding of the bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mario, I was looking on the website for the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, and they feature an 8-page document in here that's called the Equity Lens, that was a declaration signed by then Governor Kitzhaber, Ben Cannon, and Nancy Golden from the OEIB, obviously. But it talks about, it's a statement that came out, I think, in April of 2014, but it's all about the equity lens. And it's a statement, I believe they would say, of how, as those entities create policies and as they form budgets, that they are looking through the equity lens to make the decisions that they make. And it's about an 8-page document. It's pretty exhaustive. But my question is, are you aware of that? And the second one would be, how would this task force that's being proposed do something different than what has already been outlined in this document called the Equity Lens?
Chair Reed, Representative Johnson, we're very much aware of the HEC and OEIB's Equity Lens. That's why I believe this bill is a perfect fit within the HEC scope to better evaluate equity through continuing education, to ensure that folks who are working with students directly on campus are employing an equity lens on a day-to-day basis through their work. And the last thing I would say is, our institutions, I mentioned this before, but they're growing more and more diverse. And rather than students having to meet the institution where they're at, we believe that the institutions and everyone who comprises them should be meeting students where they're at when they enter college.
Did you have a follow-up? I couldn't tell. Sorry.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I hear what you're saying, Mario. I appreciate that. But I do think, again, if you get in here and you look at some of the basic features of the equity lens, and one of them is how are you collecting data on race, ethnicity, and native language, and so forth. What's the commitment to the P20 Professor Equity for Learning? It's pretty inclusive. So I guess I understand what you're saying. I appreciate what you're saying, but it does sound to me like there is a concerted effort already on the part of the OEIB in general and the HEC specifically to focus on the issues that you're championing today, which I think are great, but I'm concerned about being redundant in efforts, I guess. Let's just put it that way.
Definitely. I think this bill takes that equity lens a little further. And being a bit more focused on what we're trying to address directly in the classroom, and not specifically like we are collecting a lot of data, but what we do with that data is another story. So I think this bill goes a little further in addressing the issues that are being faced on our institutions, both universities and community colleges, with several subpopulations. And I think taking it a little further by ensuring that faculty and staff have the opportunities to access continuing education opportunities that will give them the tools they need to work with student veterans, to work with students of color, to work with students with disabilities a bit more intentionally than we have now.
So maybe I can follow up on Representative Johnson's question if there aren't other ones. The bill is relatively short, and I appreciate that, and I imagine that there's some benefit to that in the flexibility it offers, but it also is relatively light on specifics as to what the group might recommend. Can you give us a sense of what things you might imagine to be included amongst recommendations?
Yeah. Chair Reed, we're looking specifically for recommendations from the HEC after they do this research and conduct a study on cost of continuing education, what the continuing education would look like. Is it one?
And this is for faculty and staff and so on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are these trainings like 1 hour and 20 minutes, or should they be several series over the course of many months? We're looking to the HEC for best practices for continuing education requirements. And it is a little light on the prescription of what we want them to do, or what we're asking them to do. But we're very much open to talking about amendments to narrow the focus and to be more specific in what we're looking for.
So it is. I hear you say continuing education.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the extent of your intention around it, or are there other things that you'd want them to be included in those recommendations? Or I can imagine a lot of rich discussion about continuing education, mm-hmm. but I imagine there may be other things too. I'm asking you to recommend to summarize a group that doesn't yet exist, so it's sort of an unfair question, but just a sense of what things you're interested in.
We're solely interested in the continuing education aspect.
Got it. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Representative Nierman.
I just have some just little technical questions. So one of the groups that you didn't include that we've talked about on this committee a lot is people whose parents didn't go to college. Did you think about including that on your thing?
Yeah. Representative Nierman, it's hard to prescribe or write like to describe what that would be through law. I think non-traditional students, the description of that would encompass.
I got to interrupt a little bit. We have talked about that in other ones, first generation students.
First generation.
Yeah.
That's right.
I think that's pretty well defined as someone whose parents are not college graduates.
Thank you for correcting me. That, I would say, was an oversight in the drafting of this first draft of the bill. And, again, we're open to amendments. So we probably should include that within the scope of the work group. Non-traditional students, students who are first generation, very much are not at the same par when it comes to completion rates as traditional students or folks whose parents have gone through college already.
Thanks for pointing that out, Representative Neumann. Go ahead, please.
In here, you include the commission and the Oregon Health Authority. What does the Oregon Health Authority have to do with it? Is that because OHSU is involved in this, or what?
Thank you for that clarification. The Oregon Health Authority previously has done continuing education rulemaking within the same scope that we're asking them to do or to look into providing for the legislature. So we're not wanting the HEC to necessarily reinvent the wheel, but use already existing information and rules that have already been developed.
Thanks. So we have four more people to testify. We appreciate your testimony very much. That's Luis Perez, I hope. I'm reading the handwriting correctly. Mariana Paradones. And then since we have four, let's do two and two together. Thanks for being here. Who's first?
Okay, I'll go first.
Okay.
Awesome. Hi, Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name is Mariana Perdones, and I'm a student at Lane Community College and a member of the Oregon Student Association. And I'm here to strongly, strongly urge you to support HB 3308. I strongly believe that this bill is the right first step towards addressing an integral part of college life, safety, and how that impacts our ability to be successful. HB 3308 would give students, faculty, staff, and administrators a much-needed responsibility to work together and strive for addressing the disparities many traditionally marginalized communities face on a daily basis, disparities I have faced myself. I've been attending Lane Community College for three terms now as a full-time student. I can still recall my first term at Lane, and I was so eager to start. I was really, really excited to be in a place where I felt my students and peers would be really inclusive. But it was really quickly when I began to realize this wasn't the case, and I started to face a lot of microaggressions and oppressive moments every single day in and out of school. In an introductory writing class I took my first term, I had a peer make several remarks about my identity, even in the presence of my instructor. They called me a spick and a beaner and a border jumper. And one day during class, one of my instructors actually asked me if I knew where the best Mexican restaurants in Eugene were. Sorry. I felt really humiliated, and I felt really discouraged from going to my class. And this is a required class, so it's not something I could just drop. So I felt like I had to protect myself, and I had to isolate my identity and culture. And at many times, I really did despise myself and who I was. I couldn't wait for the last day of this class to happen. So, like, I was really hopeful that next term would be different, but I was really wrong. The second term I took at Lane, it was my U.S. history class where I saw how reluctant my instructor was in using inclusive language, inclusive and actually really appropriate language for underrepresented groups. My instructor told the class that he would use the term Indian to reference Native Americans and indigenous folks. I was really outraged by the lack of competence my instructor showed, and I actually had a student in that class, he was Native American, and he went with me to talk to our instructor about using the word indigenous instead. But unfortunately, our instructor didn't think that that was necessary for him to change his language, and he didn't really care. And he would also use the word Redskins to talk about Indian or Native Americans in our class. He claimed it was an infringement on his freedom of speech and that we weren't allowed to tell him how to teach his class. My peer, that's Native American, actually dropped that class the next day because he couldn't put up with the hostile language that with the hostile language our instructor was using. So that just kind of shows that there, even though, like, You try to contact your instructors and you try to tell them, like, this is harmful, can you please not say this, like, this is where I'm coming from, there's still, like, a reluctance for that to be implemented. And although a policy for cultural competency continuing education for faculty was passed on our campus at Lane Community College, the implementation of this process continues to be slowed down by the apathetic support for full implementation. I have found that it is easier for people to be outraged at actions than actually working to find solutions. In order for all students to succeed in college and beyond, students need a stronger sense of safety and belonging. And one of the first steps is ensuring that this happens by equipping our faculty and staff with tools to ensure their departments and classrooms are safe, supportive, and welcoming to all students. I know there's a hesitance that I could tell from when I was sitting back there where people are saying, "This, I don't see how this is important. Might be redundant," but I strongly urge you to kind of understand where we're coming from. This is stories from just a few people. There are tons of other college students that had it, that dropped their classes, like my friend in my class, that didn't feel comfortable and safe in their own school, where we're telling students, this is our mission for you to succeed, but we're not giving them the tools they need. This is why I support HB 3308, and I encourage this committee to pass it. Please remember my story when you're going to vote on this bill, and thank you for letting me speak with you.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. Mr. Price.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. My name is Louise Perez, and I am a student senator with Associated Students of Portland State University, or ASPSU. HB 3308 is important because we at PSU believe that this is a step in the right direction. We want the state to do research on cultural competency, what it entails, and to eventually act on making cultural competency trainings available and mandated on all the faculty and staff in higher education institutions. We ourselves have done a lot of research, and we have detected that many students that are LGBTQ, students of color, students who speak different languages, first-generation students, etc., and students who also come from different countries have disabilities visible and invisible, and we saw that many of them often felt marginalized by their instructors and staff. What we want is for everyone to know that no two students are exactly alike, and that we all come from different backgrounds. These backgrounds represent who we are, what our lives are like, and sometimes these may not match that of the faculty and staff in higher ed. We want equal access to the resources these institutions provide without fear of being marginalized for our backgrounds. I stand here before you to say that HB 3308 is a great step forward. Cultural competency is used in the medical realm widely and successfully. We, the students of PSU and other higher ed institutions, recognize the need for these trainings for faculty and staff, and we staunchly believe that this will make students more successful in the classroom and whenever we graduate and occupy job positions. This is essential for a better economy and a more globalized and inclusive society. I politely ask you to join us in this struggle and allow for the passage of HB 3308. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Questions for these two. Representative Wisnett.
I'm sorry, your name again, but thank you for both of you for your testimony. Do the schools not have like a place you can go, an ombudsman or someone to say, hey, you know, I've got a problem with my professor. Is there no opportunity to do that now? Or do you feel this, it'll hurt your, you know, what?
Yeah, I can kind of speak to that. Just from my own personal experience, I'm not going to say for everyone's experience, but I know at our campus we do have a complaint system, and they try to encourage us to use it as much as possible, but it's honestly one of the most complex processes to go through. You have to actually set up a meeting with the instructor before you put your process through. The complaint system through. So I did go meet with my instructor, and I told my instructor, like, we don't feel safe when you use these words. Like, this is a group that's really, like, integral to our campus. So there is a process for it, but it's a really complex one, and I feel like that shouldn't be the case. I feel like all teachers and all faculty and staff should have some type of understanding that people have different identities and are underrepresented, and when people misidentify them, it can be really harmful to students.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yes, please.
I want to help you. I mean, that's not right, but we need something quicker. I mean, I don't know why we need studied. I think we know that there's a problem. I think we need to organize some way where the students can voice your complaint and concern and get some action on it. As a representative, I get some emails from students who are unhappy about what was happening at the community college about treating veterans, because they had a non-veteran was running this program, and she didn't know the time sensitivity and how important it was to get this stuff in, and she wasn't getting the reports in to get them their money so they could eat and go to school. So I think I'm sorry this is happening. I wish there was some organization already there, or system or office, where you could go and voice your complaints and just do this right now. Hey, you know, a study is going to take time, and it's going to take time from a study to get actions. complain to your representative and your senator and give examples, because this shouldn't happen. So,
thank you, Representative Wisnant. And in fact, you're giving voice to part of what I was probably not very articulate about in my question about the training is one thing, but I don't know if that should be the limitation. Perhaps there are other processes and other things that ought to be considered as well. So thanks for your answer. That amplifies good. I think this is a good exchange as well. Other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you both for testifying. We appreciate you being here. Next on our list, we have Manuel Gonzalez, Christian Mello, and Joaquin Ramos, please. The gentlemen can pick your order, please. But someone does have to go first.
Fair enough. While I'm waiting for them to start their... Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisnant, members of the committee, my name is, for the record, my name is Christian Mello, and I'm a student of Lane Community College, as well as a member of the Oregon Student Association. I also serve as a member of LCC Student Government as an advocate for LGBTQ students on campus, and I'm here representing my constituents, as well as students across the state of Oregon, in support of House Bill 3308 and the promotion of cultural competency continuing education in our colleges. Lane Community College is a campus that has actually passed a cultural competency policy fairly recently, though it definitely wasn't without a large amount of struggle. Our student population fought for 5 hard years to get that policy passed. But I must say, a lot of our thanks do go to our president, Mary Spieldy, and members of the administration. They did give us a lot of support. As a member of the student government, I now sit as a member of Lane Community College's Diversity Council, which is a group that makes policies such as cultural competency happen on our campus, as well as sit on the Professional Development Committee for faculty and staff. I'd like to say that everything is rainbows and happy faces, but it's definitely not the case. Our implementation of the policy has come to somewhat of a standstill, as some members of our faculty and staff stall our consensus and governance councils across the college when it comes to these issues. On top of this, our professional development committee is even also locked up, having a hard time making simple decisions like how many college employees our policy and trainings will even apply to. While I'm a member of the LGBTQ population, I acknowledge that I have a large amount of privilege being white, a cisgender male. In classrooms, I don't experience a lot of the prejudice that I hear about from other students, but I still witness microaggressions on an average basis. Even some of my best teachers, some of the ones I feel like I've respected the most, have dropped language that might be considered racist, sexist, homophobic, ableist, and most times, students are afraid to speak up or call them out about it for fear of either humiliating themselves or repercussions that might follow. And again, a lot of people aren't even aware of our complaints process, which, as Mariana illustrated before, can be pretty complex. I hear there's some revision underway, but jury's out on that one. It's becoming very clear that something needs to be done to get this process actually moving, or at least moving faster. And if it takes work of us students to fight for what we know our institutions and faculty and staff should be doing by law, then so be it. Our college may be one of the few to have finally passed a policy which addresses these disparities. However, a work group on the HEC to pull this work together to ensure our students are done justice and are more free to pursue their education without fear of oppression would be... it would be awesome. And with that, I ask your support for the creation of this work group on the HEC and to support House Bill 3308. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Who's next? Please.
Chair Reed, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Manuel Mejia Gonzalez. I am a student at Lane Community College and Multicultural Programs Coordinator with its residing student government. I'm here today to talk to you, to ask you to support House Bill 3308. I am a member of the Lane Community College Professional Development and Implementation Committee for Cultural Proficiency. This policy we are building has not yet been implemented and is in the process. However, as my colleagues have mentioned, it keeps getting stalled by some folks who keep thinking and calling us redundant and calling this policy unnecessary. It is really imperative that our higher education institutions hold the capacity to respond effectively and respectfully to students, staff, community members, and of all cultures, languages, classes, genders, ages, military status, religious beliefs, sexual orientations, and abilities. I want to know that my institution holds a sentimentally intimate relationship with the asymmetrical relations of power that go with inside and outside of the classrooms. Furthermore, I expect the system to do what it promised to me. I expect equitable opportunity. I currently do not feel safe in a safe environment to learn and when entering my classes. Just last term, I had a professor who would very, very dauntingly and angrily look at me when he did not understand my heavy accent. While I understand that it might be a little frustrating to look at me and ask me for the second time, what was it that I said? English is my second language, and my accent is something that I do not control. I have really, really tried to get a hold of it. And it has gotten a lot better. However, the accent's still there. Just furthermore, I have been taught as less smart and in many cases given lower expectations just because of the accent that carries my words and the color of my skin. I am by no means a traditional student, but the institution should know how to treat me effectively and respectfully. I want to know that my professors know that it's more important to pay attention to the words I say instead of the accent that carry them. I want them to know that the simple fact that I am a person of color has made my life inherently different in the United States. I also want them to know that although my parents have never gone past middle school, I am by no means less intelligent, just rather do not know how to navigate college as well. I have always dreamed of a class in which I am judged by the content of my character. And assess for those specific needs derived from the content of my character specifically. I am by no means less smart than any traditional student. I deserve the same space that these students are being offered, a safe space where my learning will be at its optimal. I respectfully ask the committee to vote yes on House Bill 3308, and please remember my testimony when voting on this bill. Thank you very much and for the opportunity to present my testimony to you today.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Ramos.
Hello, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Joaquin Ramos. I go to the University of Oregon. I'm in second year, and I'm here to urge y'all to vote yes on House Bill 3308. Even though this is my second year at the University of Oregon, there has not been one day where I have not heard a homophobic slur or a racial slur on my campus by a student, by a teacher, by a faculty. It is surprising to me how incompetent culturally people are on our campus. And I don't understand how, as a student, we are asked to make other students competent within areas where we don't have the same demands for our staff and our faculty and our professors. I work for our student government as ASUO State Affairs Commissioner, and along with my coworkers in the back, Perla and Luis, we started a cultural competency movement to teach students how to interact with other students who they may have not had an experience with before. And I don't see how we can ask students to be respectful of people when professors, faculty, and staff members are not expected to have the same standards as students. I have taken a lot of classes at the university, and some of them have made sexist comments and have talked about homosexuality with biological means, which is a valid argument. However, it always ignores the fact that being non-heterosexual is not abnormal. It's just not as prevalent. So it always talks about homosexuality as abnormal within a lot of classes and within a lot of different spaces, which makes people who are non-heterosexual, like myself, It makes me feel uncomfortable and makes me feel like I'm not a normal person because I'm not studied as much in biology, or I'm not gonna be my. In anthropology, the brains of homosexual and heterosexual people were examined, which I just feel like isn't a valid explanation on intelligence in any means. So that's part of why I'm here. I also took a class about incarceration recently, and we talked about how Cambodians are one of the highest ethnicities to be incarcerated in the United States. And the student felt that it was appropriate, or the professor asked, like, why do you believe that Cambodians are one of the highest people to be incarcerated? And the student felt that it was important to say that, like, Cambodians were meant to be arrested because they're Muslim. First of all, that's an inaccurate statement. Cambodian people are, in the most part, Hindu. Or not Hindu, sorry, Buddhist. And the student followed up to say that Muslims should be incarcerated. The teacher did not know how to react to this statement and did not know how to, like, make the conversation, like, validated and be like, this is an incorrect statement. So it was just, like, left behind, and I felt like a lot of people were uncomfortable in the space, and it just made the classroom not feel inclusive to everyone anymore. If teachers don't know how to safely interact with students and intervene in oppressive situations, then it's creating an unsafe environment for all students. So that's why we're asking for cultural competency, and that's why we ask that y'all support HB 3308. And thank you for letting me speak today.
Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
Other questions for any of these panelists? Let's see. Representative Reardon.
Let's imagine the study work group and everything is done. What you must have some ideas, perhaps, about what course of action might be taken. Anybody?
You're asking what outcomes you'd like to see?
Okay. Chair Reed, Representative Reardon. I'll speak for myself. What I'm really hoping for out of this work group is just a little bit more of a standard being set, so we can have those either faster timelines or just help the college and its governance councils and its professional development committees more of a comprehensive plan as to how they're going to get everything done, because this is a continual learning process. And if we can really couple that learning process together with other institutions using a work group like this, I think it can maybe happen in a faster time, so we have fewer students not finishing college.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for your testimony. That's the list of people who have signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 3308? Representative
McHugh. Chair Reed, thank you. I thought maybe we would have some more people come up, so I was going to wait until the end to make a comment, but I'll go ahead and make it now.
Please do.
I do recall the bill that we passed in the last session regarding cultural competency at OHSU, which is one of our institutions of higher learning. Mm-hmm. So it's intriguing to me that we may not be expecting the same level of I guess you would call it training for our faculty at our other institutions of higher education, whether it's community college or at the university level. And I know OHSU is referenced as potentially a model. I think it's apparent, you know, as Representative Wisnett said, that we do have a problem that needs to be addressed here. And I'm just intrigued by this conversation as to how we may take a model that we already have, albeit in a different setting. Although it is an institution of higher learning, it's also a hospital setting. So the cultural competency is not only for patients, but for students who come through OHSU in their multitude of programs. So, you know, we do have a model that's there. I would be interested to hear a little bit more about the implementation of that and how that's working at OHSU, and it would be helpful to know a little bit more about that. Maybe there's a model there that's something that's applicable.
That's a good observation, Representative Wisnett.
Could we have Marla come up, and you know, it's Marla, and I think because we have a lot of organizations, do you have different groups at your respective universities or colleges that represent your interest, and why aren't they working with administration? I'm still don't understand why something's not happening, that you're asking for a bill to study. You got a problem, but the study it, you know, we need action. So I think maybe if the Student Association could...
It looks like these two gentlemen have a perspective on that, and then maybe we can ask Mario back up. So go ahead.
So, Chair Reed. And Representative Wisnat. We have the Division of Equity and Inclusion at the University of Oregon, and they are working on cultural competency for faculty and staff members. However, it's so big, and like our faculty is so big at the University of Oregon, it's hard for one organization to take this on as a whole. So if we have like this study and we have the state support for our university, then it would make it easier for us to implement actions at a university level to create like new trainings and to make these trainings effective for all faculty and staff members. Also, as the ASUO, we mainly deal with student needs. So as the Associated Students of the University of Oregon, we focus on student learning and student education. So we do cultural competency for students. However, for us to like enter staff and faculty, we would have to get like more power to go in there and do these trainings. That's how it's working at the University of Oregon.
Thank you.
Chair Reed, Representative Wisnant, just to clarify, you were asking whether there's been work done for students working with faculty and staff. Is that correct?
Well, your organizations exist now, yes, sir.
Right. So there are two positions within ASLCC, that's just the Associated Students of Lane Community College, that sit on the college's Diversity Council, which is one of the major governance councils on the in the college. And we have actually been working for a pretty long time with them. In fact, some of the, actually I'd say about 60% of the ground rules for the council itself were written by students and taken directly from the ground rules of the Oregon Student Association. We really have done a lot and put a lot of input. In fact, a lot of the work on the policy itself was drafted by the predecessor for my position, as a matter of fact, along with others. There hasn't been lack of effort for our organization to work with other organizations on our campus. But
I have a follow-up?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, sometimes you need punishment or you know,
consequences.
Consequences for the action. So is those rules have anything that professor is going to be monitored, or he's going to be extra trained, or you know?
That's the tough one.
Yeah.
Really, we. This is not going to be directly related to the bill, but part of the struggle is being able to make trainings and stuff like this mandatory for the people who need it, so mandatory for everyone. Because the people who are really going to need these sorts of trainings, the people who we might want to see have their wrists slapped a little harder than others, aren't going to do this because they don't believe they need it.
Thank you for responding.
No problem.
Thank you. Representative Hayden?
I'm sorry, my OLIS is not coming up like everybody else's, but I believe in the middle you had a comment. I'm sorry, I don't have your...
Oh, sure.
Yes.
Sure. Mr. Gonzalez.
It was, I believe, regarding if there's any work that's currently being done at our institutions. As we mentioned, right now, Gershon and I are working in the Professional Development Committee. However, that is told by other folks who do not believe they need this, and we can only do so much as students. I'm taking 17 credits. Mm-hmm. I took 20 last term, and Gershon is also a really busy person. It's only two of us in the Associated Students of Lane Community College. It's really, we need to have state standards to what our institutions are able of communicating with students and working with them effectively, and this is how this bill would help us.
So what I'm hearing, and feel free to jump back in, is that I don't hear anybody saying that a study is not merited. What I'm hearing people saying is a study sufficient, and should the study be limited, as we heard earlier, to the question about continuing education? Should there be other consequences? Should there be other elements to the study and to the bill? So I think we've heard already some elements that need to be amended. So we're at that point.
I think Representative Johnson and I have served in this committee, and I've served on education before it was divided to higher education. And I think we've talked about trying to be sure in the teacher education programs, that's where you start.
Yeah.
you be sure that it's being taught to teachers that are going to teach. And I think we've had some bills or talked about that as requiring that be part of the curriculum for people coming out with a teaching degree. So that's where you start it, too. So
okay. Thank you very much. Representative Johnson, thinking about it?
I think you're right, Chair, that there's a lot of awareness. There are multiple organizations on the campus levels to interact with a variety of underserved students. You know, just a quick look at the PSU website, and there must be half a dozen. So they're there, they're in place, but what's the enforcement mechanism? And I think that should probably is an institution-by-institution issue, I'm guessing. And what those criteria are, what the teeth are, I don't know. These can be complicated things. Collective bargaining agreements can come into play sometimes as well. I don't know what those entail, so... but I think the awareness is certainly there. It's what can be done to have some enforcement mechanisms.
It seems like there's at least a little. Maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it feels like there's some consensus around that as potential element to an amendment. Representative Reed?
I just throw in one thing I would want to look at if I were on such a work group, which I'm not volunteering for, but
you're seeking an appointment.
The evaluation documents and system that they use for professors, assuming there is one, does that say anything about this issue? So just another possibility.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Very good. Representative McEwen.
Chair Reed, this is just a very important conversation that we're having here today. And I, now that we have changed the governance mechanism for our university systems, I would be intrigued, and maybe this work group is what can come up with that, as to what purview we actually have in implementing something across a system that is no longer what it used to be. And another thing that comes to my mind, and I know we have some institutions in the state that do evaluations as the students exit a class, and students vote with their feet. And I don't know on your campuses if that is something that occurs where at the end of the day there's a survey done that becomes public and that students can actually make some decisions that they don't want to sign up for those classes because they find out that there's some things going on that are...
For all kinds of reasons,
and it may be academic, it may be an issue like this, but are there systems on your campuses where you do an evaluation as you walk out the door that's available to students who may be signing up for that class?
Chair Reed, Representative McKinnon, currently that is, some of those are mutually exclusive to new faculty. As in this term, I had quite a bunch of complaints, one of them being the teacher who very angrily looked at me when I wanted to speak and give my opinion in the class. He did not have a form, one of my classes did, I believe. However, the other three did not. And some of those are just concerning seniority.
So this is at the discretion of the professor, is what
yes.
you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mr. Ramos.
At the University of Oregon, you have to evaluate, well, you don't have to. You can opt out of evaluations, but you get an evaluation for every single course.
Who is you in that case?
Students.
Or faculty? Or?
Students get an evaluation. Like, we get to evaluate the course as well as the faculty member and, like, GTFs or anyone involved in the course as well. However, they get to choose the questions that are on there. So sometimes it can be, like, 20 yes or no questions. Sometimes it's, like, things that you write. But, like, when they get to implement the questions they choose... like, that's going to vary the data that's received.
Not a consistent set of questions across all the classes. Okay. Yeah.
And that is not public information to students. That goes to administrators, I think, and they use it to decide who gets tenure as well as who gets bonuses as well as, like...
But that is not available for incoming students who may be signing up for that coursework.
No.
Interesting.
I know private institutions are a different world, but I know in private institutions you have an opportunity to evaluate, and that becomes available. Interesting.
My experience in graduate school got a lot better when I stopped selecting my classes based on what subjects I thought I was interested in, and when I started picking them based on the aggregated evaluations of faculty members. From students who've gone before me.
Thank you so much.
Representative Neiman?
And just a short thing, the free market provides a great solution, ratemyprofessor.com, which I'm sure you all know about. I know that the teachers read that one, too.
Ms. Mill?
I was actually just going to remark upon that, if I may.
Please.
Chair Reed, Representative Neiman, Representative McCune. At LCC, Manuel sort of mentioned this, the evaluations are given out, and the ours are actually standardized. They're on a single sheet of paper. The teacher's told to leave the room, and a student administers them, then takes them off to the department. They're used for teachers to evaluate themselves, and as far as I know, I believe the department gets them, but they're definitely not available to the students at our college. And I was about to mention that the best tool I have had to find a teacher I know, well, at least I'm relatively sure I'm not going to disagree with, is websites like RateMyProfessor.com, which I'm pretty sure is actually owned by MTV. So things might need to change a little bit.
Got it. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Of course.
Representative Wisnett, do you still want to hear from Mario again, or do you think we've covered it for now? Okay. So I want to say, for the record, we're going to carry House Bill 3308 over to our next meeting so that Representative Gallegos, if he's back, has a chance to talk about it. And clearly we've begun a discussion that I don't think we've finished. It seems clear that there are some amendments that are merited, ranging from the addition to first-generation students that Representative Neiman highlighted, and a number of other things that have been surfaced today. So we'll hear from Representative Gallegos. I think everybody who's interested in this ought to be thinking about how those amendments ought to look, and I imagine we'll be back to the conversation as well. So thank you for the testimony. Thanks for the good discussion, everyone who's here. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3308.
I want to mention we're meeting at 8:30.
We're going to meet at 8:30 on Wednesday. So enjoy your extra half hour. And is there anything else that we need to do for today?
Sorry.
Take it when you can get it. Okay, we're adjourned. Thank you.
So we met on the affordable.